Welcome, everyone, to the second episode of our FactSet Insight Limited series, The Cloud View, where we'll be joined by experts from FactSet's cloud partners to talk about key insights for firms within the financial services industry who are on the digital transformation journey that we all seem to be experiencing every day. My name is Chris Ellis, FactSet's Global Head of Strategic Initiatives and Partnerships, and I'm thrilled to be your host today. Today, I'm joined by Junta Nakai. Junta is from Databricks. Welcome, Junta. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Yeah. Can you take a second and tell us about yourself?
Sure. My name is Junta Nakai. I run financial services, public sector, and cybersecurity go-to-market at Databricks. Databricks is a large data intelligence company, so we're a cloud data and AI platform that services about 20,000 customers around the world, including about 60% of the Fortune 500. So that's who I am, and that's what Databricks is.
Great. Given the name Databricks, given that everyone at FactSet is inherently a data nerd at heart, let's start and let's define some key terms. Let's talk about data at the most fundamental level, and then we'll sort of build up.
Yeah.
So when we think about the types of data, the categories of data that we're really talking about, I tend to think of it, or I tend to categorize it in my head as either structured data, unstructured data, and then standardized data feeds or vectorized data feeds. Yep. So Junta, before we get in and make sure we're all talking on the same page, tell us in your words what you think of as the difference between structured and unstructured data.
So by definition, structured data is things like financial data, numbers. Unstructured data is things like text, PDFs, images, video, audio, you know, things that don't neatly fit into a Excel spreadsheet, I guess, would be the line between unstructured and structured data. The other way to think about this is structured data is what institutions have been using for, you know, long, long periods of time, right? Even before we had Excel, people had spreadsheets and they're putting numbers and they're doing the general ledger and all this stuff. Unstructured data is arguably relatively newer in the sense now it's being leveraged by financial service firms to, you know, understand their customers better or understand legal documents better or to try to generate alpha. That's how I think about the distinction between the two.
So I love the way you categorize that, right? Yep. That is such a clear how the world used to be before generative AI, before we were talking about everything that we're talking about today, versus this whole massive, much larger category of information, content that was never, that had to be manipulated and changed to get any value into the financial services, financial system, financial market that we deal with every day, right? And so now let's talk about the difference between a standardized data feed and a vectorized data feed in that sort of same context.
So, you know, how you articulated, Chris, is basically saying, you know, I read the statistic the other day. I don't know how accurate it is, which is something along the lines of 99% of the world's data is unstructured by nature, right? Structured data, while very important, is a small percentage of all the data, which makes sense, right? Because it's neatly structured. I think about the same way in terms of standard and vectorized data feed, which is standard data feeds are very important, tons of use cases. I think a vectorized data feed opens up way more use cases potentially downstream. So if you're thinking about agentic systems, if you're thinking about just generative AI and being able to query a database very simply, those require something like a vectorized database, which enables far more different types of workflows and use cases off that same data set. But I think that those are kind of the big distinctions between the two.
Interesting in that you say that, where we probably before generative AI and the way technology was exposed, we probably spent 95% of our time on that 1% of the data that was structured and maybe 5% of our time on the 99% that was unstructured and how much that's changed and how much we're empowered to do that now is just an incredible measure on its own.
I think. Yeah, absolutely. Just think about it this way. Like think about a portfolio manager's workflow 15 years ago, right? They cover a particular company. They get some data, usually financial data they took from a 10K or something like that, and they effectively build a 3 megabyte Excel file, and then they try to predict earnings, right? Mm-hmm. But if you think about it just very objectively, just the complexity of what's happening in the markets, the complexity of the world, probably cannot be contained in a 3 megabyte structured Excel file, right? So this is why like the unstructured data sets, the vectorized data sets, all these things are, in addition to that, become so important because it gives you a much more holistic view of an investment, of a risk factor, of a customer, and it just enables so many other workflows that maybe we weren't even thinking about 5, 10 years ago.
Yeah. So as is often the case, technology opens up possibilities that were never there before, but then we have to figure out how to make it easier to use, how to harness it, how to bring it into our capabilities, right? And so with that as the context, what do FactSet and Databricks need to do to enhance, to enrich the data that we bring into the workflow for that portfolio manager or that sell-side research analyst, right, or that banker in order to really drive their productivity, their deeper understanding, their better, richer analysis?
Yeah, so FactSet and Databricks has a wonderful relationship and a partnership. I think we solve for two things primarily, in my opinion. There's probably many other things, but the first one is just, you know, the concept of time is money, right? Like FactSet has lots and lots of data, lots of very valuable data. The easier we make it for customers to take that data and start doing things with that data, the better it is for everybody. And that's one of the main things that we solve for, right? So it's the delivery of data. We have something called delta sharing that makes it easier to bring in data without having to ingest massive amounts of data, all this stuff. The second thing is adding the metadata, the enriched metadata around your data so that the customers who then get that data know exactly what they can do with that data. So I'll give you an example, which is like end of year. Like what does end of year mean for every company? It's very different. Mm-hmm. Some companies end their year in March, some companies in December, some companies in June. And unless you have that robust metadata around the data that you're ingesting, it's really hard to do simple things like, I don't know, PE calculations based on 12-month forward estimates or whatever that you're trying to do. It just makes it easier for you to trust that data and start using it downstream so that you could drive productivity and hopefully generate alpha or beat the market or whatever you're trying to do with that data.
Yeah. And when you think about it from the Databricks seat, why is it so important that we're doing that instead of that responsibility falling back to our mutual client?
Yeah. I mean, the simple answer is cost and money, cost and time, right? So it takes time to do that. Time is money because you have to, if you're ingesting, the same data sets from everybody over and over and over again and doing the same type of ETL and transformations that data set, if that can be delivered to you in a more standardized fashion, if that can be delivered to you in a more standardized protocol, you don't have to go through that complicated ingestion process each and every time. So that's what we can uniquely solve for. And that's why it's important that we make it easier for our customers to do that so they could focus on what they're good at, right? Which is servicing their customers, generating alpha, generating inflows, so on and so forth. That's why it's so important that we take care of it so that our customers can do more with less time.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Right.
I've personally been at FactSet for just shy of 32 years, and I remember vividly the very first session I ever had of training on my very first day at FactSet was, FactSet is a productivity tool. We exist to enhance the productivity of our clients so they can do twice as much analysis in half the time to either do even more analysis or, heaven forbid, actually have the time to digest and understand and process the analysis that they did.
Yep.
Same problem, completely different form as the technology evolves on and on.
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, every financial service company is basically just a collection of their data and their people.
Yeah.
Right. So if you could bring those two things together and get the people more productive with that data, that's the secret sauce of, that's the $1 trillion question in the industry. So absolutely.
Yeah.
We're just trying to make it, faster and better and more modern and enable lots of different types of workflows together.
So let's peel back this onion a significant layer and go a little bit in the weeds for a second on that. So we hear from clients that doing semantic modeling on SQL data feeds can be really hard.
Yes.
Especially when it's a provider's data and not their own, and they don't necessarily have the domain expertise to do it.
Mm.
How does this approach compare to something like MCP, where you're often using APIs to drive the LLM?
So, you know, MCP is short for Model Context Protocol, just to level set. And, you know, we discussed a little bit earlier about how to explain this. Some of my colleagues tell me it's like a kindergarten teacher setting rules in a playground. I think of it as more kind of like a HTTP for the internet, but same for AI models. In financial services, it could be what Swift is for banking. It's kind of the, you know, it's a set of rules that drive interoperability between data in different models, right? So for example, imagine if you are a risk manager at a bank, right? So you have a risk system, you have a CRM system, you have a trade system, all this stuff. You have to have a common understanding of a particular risk limit is so that the models and the things that you do with that can interact with that and have a standard approach to that. That's what MCP basically solves for. It removes that difficulty of setting standards across multiple different systems and being able to drive that consistency across certain many use cases together in a simple way, so you could have true interoperability between the data and the models and different applications that you might have running at any institution. And largely speaking, these can be in the hundreds in terms of the systems at many larger organizations. It's just that it makes it easier to build these kind of workflows and move into the Gen AI era with MCP.
Great. So let's climb out of that rabbit hole and go to a more general question.
Yeah.
So many of our clients today are still at the point in the journey where they're looking at their traditional data warehousing versus the benefits, the choices, that decision about going to more of a cloud-based data warehousing model for their needs.
Yeah.
Where do you, as you talk to clients in this ecosystem, what are some of the key perspectives or what is the key choices today that are influencing those clients on that decision to make that move, irrespective of Databricks, between the traditional data warehousing and the cloud-based?
I think just, you know, taking a step back, the legacy technologies tightly coupled compute and storage, right? And as we talked about earlier, there's this been proliferation of data. So if you have just a traditional, you know, on-premise data warehouse, it's really hard, if not impossible, to handle the proliferation of unstructured data, number one. Number two, it's even hard to do things like Python, right? Because by definition, these are kind of SQL warehouses. So the benefit of moving to the cloud for a lot of our customers, or, you know, not just Databricks customers, but in general, is the separation of storage and compute. Those can scale irrespective and independent of each other, which has tremendous, you know, time to insight implications, tremendous cost implications, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The other big part is, you know, do you want to be, you know, just a SQL first organization, or, you know, a Python first organization, or maybe like an agentic first organization in the future? Having a modern cloud architecture that enables interoperability, you know, cheap storage, open formats, open source foundations, that enables many of the building blocks to be built from that, not just reporting, you know, not just some SQL queries that you may have been doing in the past. So it's kind of a more of a future-proof way to start building your architecture in order to embrace yourself and prepare yourself for the AI or agentic age that, you know, is coming today.
So that answer makes perfect sense to me. But now spin it just a little bit. For someone who was maybe an earlier adopter of the cloud or a hybrid, has a hybrid approach today, and they're looking at Databricks relative to their legacy cloud partner in whole or in part, what are the forces, sort of what are the influencers that are driving them towards the key elements, the key foundational benefits of Databricks?
So all three cloud vendors are investors in Databricks, and we love them equally.
Okay.
But I answered it, you know, in this way, which is to be a customer of Databricks or to be a partner of Databricks, you basically have to believe four things, in my opinion. You have to believe that cloud is the future, and more specifically, multi-cloud is the future, right? It's specifically in places like Europe, there's DORA regulations, there's more questions being asked, is your cloud provider a source of systemic risk for a financial service organization? They really need to think about that. So, you know, not only is cloud the future, I think multi-cloud is the future. I think the second thing you have to think about is AI important to you, right? Mm-hmm. And I think almost everybody would say, yes, AI is very important to us. The third thing you have to believe is that data is gonna grow. Volume, velocity, just the importance of like everything about data is going to grow tremendously over the next few years. And then the fourth thing you have to believe is that our open formats, open source, you know, open things, interoperability, is that the way in which large tech decisions should be made in the past, in the future, sorry. And if you kind of think about these four things, this is why I think we have, you know, 1,500 plus customers in financial services around the world, is because, you know, no vendor really ticks all four of those boxes, mm-hmm. by definition, right? If you're a cloud vendor, you're by definition not multi-cloud. You know, if you're a cloud data warehouse, you're, you know, by definition a sometimes a proprietary system that's hard to do interoperability with. So if you believe in these four things, it's just Databricks provides that interoperability, that, you know, lack of vendor lock-in through open source, open formats, et cetera, and just makes it easier to get focus on the things that drive value for your organization without thinking about the plumbing. Cloud services are fantastic, but there's hundreds of them, right? So if you look at a provider like Amazon Web Services, which is the dominant, you know, cloud in the world, and you look at all the proliferation of the services that they have, it looks like a periodic table, right? There's tons of different types of services. In order to do something that like a Databricks can do, you have to stitch together lots of different things together to try to go and to replicate that, right? And that's possible, but you have to think about the complexity, the cost, how these different components work together, so on and so forth, where Databricks is just a prepackaged solution that says, hey, here's all your data in a single place that you could do everything from AI to BI from that single place and get focused on the things that make your company differentiated. So I think about it from that lens.
Junta, as I was listening to you talk about those four different key pillars there, and I was thinking about it and sort of cross-checking it against the conversations I have with our clients every day as they're on their cloud journey, their infrastructure journey in the year 2025, one area that I was hoping you could drill in on a little bit more is the challenges and how Databricks helps them with the orchestration of different data sets, different workflows, different APIs, different parts of a process in the overall need that they're trying to solve?
Sure. I think that's a super important question. And there's two layers to that answer. The first part is the actual connectivity to those data sets and data systems. So they could be API driven, they could be some sort of other system. But we have a philosophy of helping your customers bring that data as quickly as possible and as easy as possible. So we have something called Lakeflow Connect that already integrates with some of the most common data sets or data systems out there, like Oracle or, you know, so on and so forth. Or you could have the whole interoperability, which is bring a partner tool to do the ETL and the data ingestion, right? So that's kind of the openness that we have, is you don't have to do it through a Databricks-specific tool. You could bring in the best-of-breed technology that you might be using or you're happy with to be able to orchestrate that data coming into a Databricks. Now, that's kind of the more tactical stuff. The more strategic stuff is what happens on top of that, because once you have the data from all these different systems into a single place, that's great. But if they're not governed, you just have the data in a single place that's not usable, right? So the secret sauce of Databricks is something called Unity Catalog, which is an open source Linux Foundation project. Just basically think of it as an end-to-end data governance system. So from the moment that data comes in, what is in that data? How is it being transformed? You know, who's touching that data? Where is it going? That lineage, that governance, the monitoring, all can be done through Unity Catalog, through Databricks in a single pane of glass. That's the key feature that makes all the data that you brought into the system now usable and trustworthy, so you could actually power those downstream use cases. So the governance layer is really the secret sauce that makes it all work.
So then the billion-dollar question, yes, or multi-billion-dollar question, yeah, when you think of that governance layer, mm, you think of that special sauce, mm, that unique value prop, how does that shape the investment areas, the roadmap of where Databricks is going to pour gas in the coming year.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's central to every single thing that we do, especially when we talk to financial service customers. The first things that we talk about are typically governance, because that is the, you know, that is the foundation in which they, you know, enable all these different use cases, as you know. How this changes our investment philosophy. I don't know if it changes it, but one of the major philosophies that we have is, if you just think about the number of people at an organization that are data scientists or data engineers versus the number of people that are not data scientists or data engineers, obviously there's a huge delta between the two, right? So if you looked at Databricks, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, it was a very powerful platform, typically used by technical personas that were either building models or bringing data in, so on and so forth. If you look at Databricks today, it is a platform that is used by lots of business personas. So some of our largest financial service customers have 10,000 monthly active business users on our platform. And my guess is many of them don't know they're even using Databricks, because what's happening is you can build a lightweight application on top of the data that are more attuned to someone's workflow. So the that's a long-winded answer of saying, I think the future of Databricks and where the product is going is the true democratization of data and AI to non-technical people in addition to the technical folks, right? So we have products like Databricks One, which is basically a non-technical interface to be able to ask questions of your data, you know, so on and so forth. So the one of the big drivers of our product right now is the democratization of that data. The second big area of focus for us is something we call lake-based, but effectively, you know, we pioneered this term called lake house, which is, you know, maybe it was 5 years ago or something like that. We said, hey, you know, you could have a data warehouse and a data lake. Why can't you do those things, two things together from a single place, right? You could have the, you know, the scalability and the cheap cost of a data lake, but you could have the query performance and the, you know, power to the power different applications from a data warehouse. Why don't you do those two things together? And we call that the lake house, right? And that's become like a big category. I think the next big thing that's going to happen is the combination of a OLTP, a transactional database, with an OLAP, which is an analytical database. Today, those two things are very separate. So, for example, a transactional database is something like a database that powers a particular, you know, customer list that you have. So if you take yourself off an email list, you know, it takes you off of this database, right? And then there's platforms like Databricks who are used to do analysis and build models on that data. And those two things today are largely separate. What Databricks is doing next is saying, hey, those two things can be done together. You could power an OLAP and OLTP from Databricks. So that means, you know, you power your applications and also do the analytics from a single place. This becomes really important in an agentic future, because at the end of the day, every agent has to have some sort of database behind it, right? So if you have a proliferation of agents, you can't have a human try to figure out how do I stitch these two things together. We recently acquired a company called Neon, and they were saying that they were seeing, and they're very, very advanced a company, they were saying 80% of the databases that they were seeing created were created by agents, right? Not humans, right? So in an agentic future, you need to have a tight coupling of those two, and that's where I think we'll see a lot of innovation from the Databricks side over the next, you know, let's say, 1 to 2 years.
Junta, as we think about what you just described there, what are the similarities, what are the differences when you think about Databricks clients in financial services versus so many of the other industries that you guys work with?
I think there's probably a lot more similarities than differences. I mean, the similarities are governance is foundational. It's, you know, real-time data is increasingly important. Unstructured data is increasingly important, so on and so forth. So the North Star in which people operate, I think, are largely similar across our 20,000 plus customers around the world. That being said, there are nuances because, as you know, in a financial service type of environment, it's a highly regulated environment. So the risk appetite to go explore and do different types of use cases is very different from, let's say, a startup. You know, like, so the way I categorize it is very simple, which is startups are designed to fail and fail quickly. Financial service organizations are literally designed never to fail, right? So the risk appetite in order to explore things are a little bit different. So what do I mean by that? Which is, if you look at a non-financial service industry, for example, their use cases tend to be more customer-facing or revenue-generating, right? So if you have an app that, I don't know, does X, Y, or Z, it's easier to incorporate AI and Gen AI into those applications so that you could have differentiated conversations with your customers. In a financial service organization, it's really difficult to put financial advice in an app to give to a retail customer, right? Because a regulator says, why did you do this? You know, what were the protocols or the guardrails, et cetera? You have to be able to explain this. So in financial services, a lot of the initial use cases around AI tend to be around, you know, back office or, you know, non-customer facing type use cases, right? Because people like in compliance and legal are much more comfortable deploying AI in those different places, in those type of places, rather than like a front office place. So there are those kind of, you know, differences between the two. As a result, what's happening is that there is this, you know, massive interest today in financial services of how do we use this technology to enhance the productivity of our people, right? It's not just, you know, how do we just, you know, use it to put in an application and generate, you know, X, Y, Z of revenue, but how do we really do it to enhance the productivity? Kind of like what you said before, like, you know, fact that it's at the end of the productivity. It's incredibly important because if you look at most other industries, and if you look at their P&L, their largest costs are, you know, electricity, it's cloud bill, it's, you know, it's cost of goods sold, it's materials, et cetera, et cetera.
Plant, equipment,
exactly, PP&E, like things like that. If you look at financial services, their single biggest cost is almost always going to be people, right? Compensation expense can run from 30 to 50% for every financial service organization. That means if you can get those people more productive, the impact on your bottom line can be tremendous, right? So there is this laser focus on how do we deploy AI in such a way that makes our people better and more productive at what they do so they could, you know, focus a little bit more on higher value activities. I think that's kind of the differences that I'm seeing between the two.
Once again, peel that back a little bit, and that the answer you gave feels almost ubiquitous around financial services.
Yeah.
But what are some of the key differences in there between maybe buy side and sell side, or buy side, sell side, and wealth management?
Okay.
Understanding how much similarity there is in that answer you just gave to all three areas.
Yep. So the way I would answer this is the end use cases that companies typically start off with are slightly different between those three sub-verticals that you mentioned. So, for example, on the sell side, the largest data and AI workloads tend to be in risk management first, because oftentimes it's market data that's already sitting in the cloud. It doesn't require lots of like PII data, and you're doing market calculations or, you know, VAR calculations or simulations on that data, and you're using the scalability of the cloud to, you know, identify multiple black swan scenarios so that you could manage your risk better. Those are the type of use cases that banks typically start off with. And it goes back to the productivity question, because these are very complex processes that are happening that are largely manual today. Risk practices at large banks are, you know, fairly manual processes. There is tremendous gains to be had of deploying some sort of automation and augmentation in those processes. So not only can you get to a risk question, you know, answer a risk question faster, but there's tons and tons of people that are involved, and you can automate that and have better governance, so on and so forth. So on the sell side, those are the risk management type use cases, the first ones to come. On the buy side, it's usually around investment analytics, right? Investment analytics, because again, these are, you know, third-party data sets coming from FactSet, putting it together with their primary research, and they're trying to do, you know, it could be, you know, obviously alpha generation is the main goal, but, you know, like TCAs, transaction cost analysis, like how effective are we at trading a particular security, you know, versus benchmark, and doing calculations around that. And those are, you know, high value use cases that can save a firm lots of money. Those are areas that people tend to focus on first. In wealth management, it's all about next best action, right? And how do we cover a, let's say, a wealthy individual, you know, in a differentiated manner than, you know, anybody else. And there's this big transition happening, and I think it's called the Great Wealth Transfer, which is there is now a generational shift of who owns those assets, right? So, you know, this is a broad generalization, but it's really coming, moving from, you know, husband to wife, and then wife to child, and how those people want to be covered and the assets that they care about, right? So your child might care, you know, the younger generation might care about ESG investing and you know, like social impact and all these different things, right? Whereas the previous generation may, you know, really didn't care about that kind of stuff, but they cared about something else. So the way in which you personalize and segment a customer and have a conversation, they call it, you know, segmentation of one. Mm-hmm. How could you have a really bespoke conversation with those people to differentiate yourself versus your peers is the main focus. So the end use cases are, you know, quite, you know, foundation are similar, but like the end use cases where people typically start off with are very different between those three subsegments.
Great. Take a second and let's zoom out a little bit. Reflect on, for if you will, on what were people thinking about today that they weren't even thinking about 3 to 6 months ago.
Right.
Then I'm going to ask you to peer around a corner, but let's start there.
Well, the obvious answer is, you know, the word agentic didn't really exist 6 months ago, right? Maybe a year ago, the buzzword was generative. Everything was generative. And I remember a year or two ago, I read about, like, and people just put the prefix gen in front of everything. So gen FI, so generative finance, or generative this, or generative that, right? And then today, people realize, hey, it's great to have these generative AI capabilities, but the real power is putting many of them together and have an agent that can reason and do a different tasks, or what they call multi-agent that could, you know, do complex tasks from all these different protocols. So that's kind of the main shift that's happened in, let's say, the last year or so. In the next iteration.
Now let's bend around the corner. Yeah. And with that as sort of a context or a backdrop, yeah. Where do you have any sort of insights or any best guesses as to what we're going to be thinking about in six months or 12 months?
So it's a bold prediction,
sure,
but like I think the word agentic is gonna go the way of the word generative, which means in 6 to 12 months we probably won't even be talking about agentic, because you know agentic is, if you think about it, it's just a means to an end, right? The real end is a workflow, really, right? Agentic systems are important in the sense that it could accomplish a particular workflow. So in 6 to 12 months, I don't think we'll be talking about like the hows and the whats. It's more about like maybe we call it workflow AI or human augmentation AI or whatever that word is. It's all about going after a particular complex workflow that a human does today, or a system of AI agents and generative capabilities and LLMs can come together and focus on the solution of what that builds. So it's more of an ends rather than a means. And that's super important in financial services. You know, we just talked about the compensation expense that these mm-hmm. big organizations are humongous. But just think about the difference between like software and a workflow agent, let's say, or workflow AI, right? So let's just make a dichotomy and say there was, you know, generative AI and then there's like workflow AI, right? You know, these generative AI capabilities initially are very important because it can help you do a task better, mm-hmm. faster, right? It helped you summarize a document better and faster. And that has, you know, that has tremendous productivity purposes, right? Like if I don't have to go through a 100-page annual report, I could ask questions of that, fantastic, right? So, but it solved a specific task, right? What the future is going to be is around solving specific complex workflows, you know, across the board at these organizations. Who does these workflows today, right? Humans do these workflows today. So then if you think about it, and this is why it's so important, is that the total addressable market of what we're doing no longer becomes tech expense or software expense or software spends. It becomes compensation expense. That mm-hmm. is the TAM that these companies can now go after. This is why OpenAI is worth, you know, $500 billion and so on and so forth, right? So I think the next iteration is really going to be focused on what specific workflows can we help organizations do better, faster, cheaper, and free up the time for their valuable people to go focus on something else or spend more time with customers, spend more time generating new ideas for investments, so on and so forth. So I think the main focus around you know, workflow AI or, you know, specific things that we could do to really drive returns from productivity and revenue gains using AI as the foundational technology.
So when you think about all of those potential workflows,
yeah.
How do you sort of think about usage? How do you think about KPIs? where do they come in to the analysis of what you should be doing, where you should be prioritizing in that world?
So, you know, I always think the North Star should be top or bottom line numbers, right? Like, mm-hmm. is it helping me generate more top line, or is it helping me generate more bottom line, right? But then obviously that's much easier said than done. So, you know, I had this conversation with a CTO a couple months ago, and it was, you know, he was joking, but he says, hey, I get yelled at by my CFO all the time. And the CFO always says, hey, ChatGPT came out a few years ago. I gave you all this money to invest in Gen AI. Where's my return? Right? And that return can no longer be, people are doing this 30% faster. That's great, but at the end of the day, you know, you need to show an ROI for what you're doing. So I think what the most sophisticated customers I see doing are treating use cases like a sales cycle, right? So they will have a dashboard. They will have the 500 use cases they're focused on or they can deploy. They have an idea, what is the business value for each of those use cases? What stage are we in each of these use cases? Who is the business champion for their use cases? And the executives look at this dashboard on a daily basis, and they know, you know, what's the pipeline of use cases? What use cases are in production? How much value are we generating from the use cases? And they treat it like a sales cycle, right? They're looking at the pipeline, they're looking at the consumption, they're looking at the prioritization, and they say, hey, these are the three areas we really want to make a bet on. It looks like they're technically feasible. These are the right business champions. We have the great buy-in. Now let's go focus on this. So it's kind of this, you know, institutionalization of what use cases do we do, what is the delivery that we can generate, and having the KPIs and metrics around it. And the ultimate metric should be, again, you know, revenue generated or, you know, profit generated relative to what they were doing in the past. And that is the North Star, I think, where people are looking at today.
Junta, thank you so much for joining us today. This was absolutely fantastic. We really appreciate all of your insights and your wisdom as we're all navigating through today's world. So thank you again.
Thanks for having me. It's exciting.
Yeah. We hope you enjoyed this episode and were able to come away with some important insights for your own digital transformation journey. Be sure to follow FactSet Insight on YouTube or Apple or Spotify for some coming episodes from the Cloud View Limited Series podcast. View our website and check out our social channels for more information on the FactSet and Databricks partnership. Thanks again.